Yoo-hoo! Home again.
Home again, home again, jiggity jig. Good evening, Jay.
Evening, fellas.
Hello, everybody. That was the clip from the film Happening.
You're listening to a podcast about buildings and cities. I'm Luke James.
And I'm George Gingell.
And this is a sort of a little postscript to our discussion of Neuromancer, although I'm not sure when we're going to release it. We were originally going to do this within the two Neuromancer episodes.
Or the one Neuromancer episode and this.
But in practice, there was quite a lot to talk about, so this is going to become its own thing.
Dear listener, the ratio of research to noodling and talking is much better when it comes to like reading a book than dredging through arcane modernist French architects.
Well, should we just say what we're doing? So we're talking about Blade Runner, a 1982 American neo-noir science fiction film.
Oh,
directed by Ridley Scott.
Yeah, that sounds like some classic wiki prose.
And we're not gonna. I don't know what we're gonna do. We're just gonna talk about it. The film tells the story of Rick Deckard, a Blade Runner, a bounty hunter who hunts down and terminates escaped android replicants who, in contravention of the law, have left their workplaces in the off-world colonies and come to Earth. It's the story of four escaped androids who have come to Earth to seek the extension of their life and who he has to hunt down and kill in succession.
Yeah, none of that really matters that much.
Well, it sort of is it's the plot, but the film is really much more about atmosphere. It has a very kind of rich and detailed sense of sort of fantastical setting. And it also has tended to raise questions for people about, you know, what it is to be human.
But often I really think it raises the wrong questions.
Yeah.
In people. I think there are some interesting questions, but I don't think they're about, like, what piece of work is a man.
As a bridge from our previous episodes, I thought I'd read this, which is a quote from William Gibson. "I was afraid to watch Blade Runner in the theatre because I was afraid the movie would be better than what I myself had been able to imagine. In a way, I was right to be afraid because even the first few minutes were better. Later, I noticed that it was a total box office flop in first theatrical release. That worried me too. I thought, uh-oh, you got it right and nobody cares. Over a few years, though, I started to see that in some way it was the most influential film of my lifetime."
Do you think when he says of his lifetime he means in his life, or do you think he means for everyone?
I think he means for everyone, yeah.
Yeah, that's big statements.
Yeah. Ridley Scott is renowned for the effect and the construction of images in his films. He's someone who is extremely meticulous. In Blade Runner, there's one of the things which is very visible is the influence of painting, which I think we'll probably come back to. And I think also it happens that probably the strongest point of his career.
Yeah, it's probably fair. I mean, I think you have a classic trajectory that directors will often get the thing that their sort of sense out quite early. Yeah. Like, I was thinking, this is such an aside, I was thinking about one of the things in this, which is, it's like, it has some similarities with, like, very different, with Nicholas Roeg, however you pronounce his name.
Yeah.
Like, who is a completely different filmmaker. But at a similar sort of time in his career, produces these things which are like have a fusion of dreamy and the thing that they are, or a fusion of sort of time and space and the thing they are. And then once he's got that out of the way, it's pretty, in his case, a pretty precipitous decline in quality.
Let's just begin. So, you know, cue the Vangelis music, and we're flying over. This inky black landscape lit with the flames of these oil flares, referred to in the production process as hell. It's this sort of landscape-like view of this sort of exploitative production of materials.
It's essentially like a massive petrochemical plant going on forever.
Yeah.
In dark dusk.
Out of the middle of which rise one of the key settings, which are the pyramids of the Tyrell Corporation. Which somehow, you know, I think if you had a choice of where to build them, you wouldn't put it in the middle of an enormous petrochemical plant. But maybe that's
the
all...
The petrochemical plant is the entirety of the planet.
It is, kind of. It's the landscape condition. Interestingly, this sort of, like, hellish, uninhabitable exterior, it's not really very much in evidence in the rest of the city. It's one of the things which is very clear in the book the film is based on, Philip K. Dick's Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, in which, as in like a number of his books, there's been like a big kind of nuclear war or whatever, and you can't really be outside for very long. Everyone has to put on breathing apparatus to go outside and all this sort of thing. Although in Dick, it's in like this very like affectless kind of blank, yeah, sort of deadpan way. Whereas, as with everything in Blade Runner, in this case, it's intensely sort of infused with dark romanticism and atmosphere. But then actually, as soon as we get anywhere, everyone's hanging around outside all the time eating
noodles.
Yeah,
because actually I think it's the thing for me with it is that it's very, very much about the concerns of 60s, 70s, 80s, slightly new, like sort of liberal worries about the development of cities, particularly like LA. Yeah. And it's that combination of like apocalyptic concern about the environment, either through malign, you know, nuclear war, or just sort of pollution. Those inversions where you get like smog, yeah, building up over the city, changing the entire atmosphere. And that the idea that the human effect becomes universal. Which is, I was like, I think it's from Sloterdijk. I can't remember the reference. It's in one of the books. He's got a bit which is the beginning, you know, the Germans lobbing chlorine in one of their attacks in the First World War, saying this is the beginning of the modern, when you switch from, like, attacks on people to one of the pervasive environment, you know, where like, the concern is no longer that we will do something terrible to each other, or that the environment will crush us. Our actions will have, like, so degraded the planet as to make it no longer a place for living. That is a background, very strong background, for Blade Runner. And I think there's a thing where it's sort of like white flight. Like, white flight has gone on in a kind of planetary scale. Everyone's gone to live off-world, or suburbia, in this case. You know, and what is left is the, like, dying inner city, which in fact by this point was about to start to kick back into gear, I think. The other thing is, I recently, yeah, shout out to a friend of the show, Chris, who has a massive video setup. So I watched it for the first time in high quality, as opposed to, like, on busted up VHS, which I think was the standard format of my youth. And it suddenly does look like the entire thing is made of plastic. Like, not very big plastic, when you see it sort of clearly.
Yeah.
And everything is quite clearly, like, rotoscoped, or however they did it to make things swoosh around.
There's some lovely shots. There's a lovely, like, photo set of shots of the model shop for this film, and them setting up this one. And the way in which, I don't know who is going to enjoy listening to this, but whatever. Like, the way in which this one is composed is these sort of little flat, almost like laser cutouts.
I think they're probably etchings.
Yeah, they would. Yeah, they would have been.
I think they're probably resistance etchings.
Yeah, and just like row after row after row of them, but all two dimensional. And yeah, then they're lit, and then I think the flames are shot. It's a separate exposure, probably.
I think there were many. They're definitely a separate exposure. And I think one of the techniques they were using here, which I recall on one of the DVD extras from a long time ago, is that they would use a rail. And then re-expose. So in some places they would layer two things on top of each other. And sometimes they would just re-expose the same film several times by running the camera with an interlink,
yeah,
to a rail. So it goes along, you can light it, and then re-expose it with another lighting.
Yeah, but it's just important to be clear. So that, like, it's moving at exactly the same speed,
yeah,
in every take. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or like the film is moving at exactly the,
yeah,
same.
Yeah, that's so it.
The same frame is connected to the... Yeah. I mean, actually, the next scene which happens is the interview. Let me tell you about my mother.
I think the scenes are like, I think it's a good one because it's got a sort of interior modernist scene, and like the signifiers of that are quite fun. That one's nice because it's the rather like hack on SenseNet. It's more or less the only time you're in the middle class world, which is left. The middle class world has left the planet and it's got these like residual bits, and there's still a few salary men around in the pyramids and things.
They're doing this interviewing technique to find out who the replicants are. It's actually shot in the Los Angeles Central Station. It's kind of lit from these high-level windows. We have these cubicles in which the interviews are taking place. And it's also, I think, the drifting smoke from everyone's cigarettes is very important.
Well, in fact, I mean, the atmosphere in this film is always translucent. And it's more than just smoking. It's like the whole world is a haze and smog. Something else that's really key about the city is it's still LA. And part of the way to make it still LA is by shooting on loads of real locations in the city. As if they just aged a bit, and that's one of this. And it screams noir because it's a noir film location. It's the police station, the actual one. Yeah, sorry, rail station. But it's then done up.
Yeah.
The way you create part of the noir atmosphere is by reusing the same places, but modifying them extensively.
There's like a real density of visual references. It also looks like a lot of other films or a lot of other classic photographs. This filtering through of light through these kind of clerestory windows. I've got on my computer like a whole folder full of like endless screenshots from this film, which I occasionally
so we keep like, whenever we do one of these like subjects you suggest, yeah, we keep discovering your like pet obsessions.
Yeah, well, why would we not? Yeah. Why not? They haven't all been. Some of them aren't. So then, well, should we talk about the street? Because that's actually where the film goes to next. So the film moves on to the encounter with the hero, the Harrison Ford sort of detective protagonist. And the street is always incredibly full. In a funny way, although we keep talking about the world has sort of been abandoned, but actually the street as we experience it is this sort of soylent green Malthusian nightmare of complete overpackedness and fullness. You can't walk anywhere because everyone has left.
It's just that white middle class people have moved to the suburbs. That's a major difference. So leaving the mixed race people and the sort of counterculture in squats in the centre of the city, right? I mean, that's sort of the image. It's like that image of, like straight white flight, basically.
Everything is sort of neon lit.
Like, even if you haven't seen it, you've seen it, because it's dark, hyper-city, Asian-influenced nightscape.
Always raining,
bustling people of, like, diverse nature.
Yeah, strange costumes.
Jostling the police and cars moving very slowly.
Neon.
Hawkers.
Televisions. Rubbish.
Ramen joints.
Yeah. Yeah, you have to queue to get your bowl of ramen, of nondescript ramen noodles. Everything is rammed.
And the ramen noodles are sort of the like one with and one without persuasion.
And I guess that there's a sense that the ground is where it's also, you know, in one sense people have fled to the off world, but in another sense also the well-to-do are in the air. So you've got like the flying cars, which people get around on. So where the people who are walking on the ground really is where the underclass are.
Yeah, it's sort of strategic. And I think very important that the sort of moon is this like airship advertising boarding, which is telling everybody to go and live off-world with its tentacles. And whenever you look up, you know, whenever you are in the gutter staring up at the stars, you're not. You're staring up at this cosmic force telling you to leave. And it has another sort of old world. It's not the terrifying future of cities that, like, I was familiar with growing up, which is that everyone would live in, like, compounds a million miles apart from each other, in huge buildings, being whisked between them by strangulating circulation. Modernism. It's got an old world charm of like tiny little streets and people shuffling around. And you can see it's actually kind of like to the London eyes of today, extraordinarily ripe for gentrification. It's got everything you want.
It's kind of inventively, it's just a kind of street set which they happen to have on the lot, which has been sort of dressed in a way which makes it futuristic, but also in that very sort of dark and brokenly futuristic way that's characteristic of the setting.
Another like incidental quality of that is that it means that the ends of it are these massive like painted panels, which has this strange sort of Hitchcockian, it creates a kind of abstraction which is immersive.
Well, in a way we are kind of just going through the settings. The next one that the film takes you to is to the inside of the pyramid. If you want to go there.
Well, I think the pyramid and Deckard's flat have got an interrelationship, which is that they are both, they're of a sort of interior, actually, which is like Hollywood. The pyramid, the interior of the pyramid is like a Hollywood mansion in the 22nd century, you know. But it's essentially a golden era Hollywood mansion, complete with like mock Aztec detailing, heteroclite collection of, sorry, like all over, you know, like old world furniture and owl and her outfit is extremely sort of.
Do you like our owl?
It's artificial.
Of course it is.
Must be expensive.
Very.
Oh, so we should say who's in the scene. Like, they just, you know, he goes there and he meets the guy who's the head of the Tyrell Corporation and this assistant, his lovely assistant. And their owl as well.
Yeah, and their owl. And it is really, I mean, that really is like the beginning of, what's the like lobby of the perfume company in The Thin Man?
I can't remember.
Yeah, but it's like that like incredibly ritzy Hollywood.
Yes, it's this dim, lustrous, incredibly rich materials, but lit by this kind of crepuscular orange sun sort of glancing off everything. So it's, you don't see, in a way it's glitzy, but it's not. It's
like you look out with this massive picture window on a sea of smog.
It's the glitz of, it's kind of glitz with the lights turned tastefully low, isn't it?
Yeah, twilight. Part of the reason it's noir isn't just that the themes are dark, is that it's shot at night.
The owl is one of the ways in which the film has this sort of strange relationship to the source text. As in, it's something which is in both, but the effect of which is completely different in the film. So in the book, everyone is buying animals. Everyone's obsessed with owning animals. It's one of these like Philip K. Dick, but really high on drugs ideas. Everyone is obsessed with having an animal because all the animals are extinct. There are almost no real animals anywhere
anymore.
Which
actually is in Neuromancer as well.
Yeah.
In Neuromancer, like horses have gone extinct. He sees a stuffed horse. And I think this is to do with the environmental, the fear, the liberal fear of either nuclear war or industrial pollution or whatever.
In the book, it's this sort of Philip K. Dick kind of deadpan surrealism where they have Deckard and his wife in the book have a robotic sheep, which they have purely for reasons of sort of status. And during the course of the book, he's actually just trying to get the money for this bounty hunting so that he can buy a real animal of some kind. And everyone keeps looking at the catalogue of prices for real animals. It's like this sort of auctioneer's catalogue. And it's all like really weird. And then if I remember rightly, at the end of the book, he ends up buying like a real toad. And that's the end.
You can also see why this was not included. I mean, there's a bit of this.
But
it sort of is the thing.
Yeah,
it's sort of in the background.
Yeah.
But I think in the background it's serving to create a feeling of, like, artificiality rather than...
Also kind of wonder, you know, this, like, extraordinary eagle owl in the scene, which is meant to be artificial, is this symbol of kind of, like, it's this kind of Promethean power, that wielded by the Tyrell Corporation to make this amazing owl.
If you've got like an incredibly bleak setting, one of the things you can do with it is have moments of transcendence.
Yeah.
Which is not like handled very differently in Philip K. Dick. Yeah. He's not really into that sort of transcendence. You know, he's not really into like The dancing particles of air pollution are ready to turn into angels.
Yeah.
The robot owl is ready to be a goddess of wisdom or an ineffable observer. That's kind of the solution. I think that's like the thing that is happening with the grimness. Whereas I think in the original one, the kind of grotesque is going on.
If you're going to encounter God in this world, it's going to be at the top of a pyramid, isn't it? It makes sense that that would be where it is.
Yeah, at the top of the world is where where the Olympian gods are, maybe. Yeah. That's where like you go up and meet and the characters up there kind of are Olympian gods. But there is actually, I think, a god. Oceanic feeling or the sublime or whatever. And that you encounter everywhere. The whole film is full of it. In the background, which like is really just like pointing towards that notion is really what a lot of the stuff which people find so inexplicable is, I think. Yeah. A lot of the like funny snapping back and of time and of the dream about the unicorn and yeah. I think that's all just that the solution to the grimness and the like cool dried outness, you know, there's no.
That's what throws it into relief, isn't
it's
it?
It's one of the things. Yeah. I mean, there was another thing which I'm sorry, I'm waffling off, but I think there's lovely bits where there are children in this world, and there's great moments where people like kids will run through or cycle through, not the like dwarf weird street gang, but there's a bit.
The dwarfs.
There's there's
the little robot dwarf things. Yeah.
Oh no, but there's also the like crazy street gang of dwarfs who like steal the back of his car.
Oh, fuck, yeah, I forgot about that. Yeah.
A lot of dwarfs used in this production. It's definitely keeping the LA dwarf community in chips.
Yeah.
And it sort of does... That reminds me of... I think I mentioned it before. It's funny that I'm thinking of... But the early Kurosawa film, his second one after the war, Stray Dog, which has, like, at the end, there's a point where, like, we've come to the end of the noir... The criminal's being caught and they're lying in a field and he knows he's going to get executed. And then these, like, primary school children come down the road singing their primary school song. And, like, what has been this cool, dark, underside world is cast into life by this, like, you know, what is the thing that people... What is the most common way people can kind of, like, rationalise and justify their lives, their tiny, fleeting lives? You can get married and have kids and, like, talk of fertility and this sort of beautiful, like, solution to giving life meaning. And that just, like, passing by in this dark world is another... And then is a more kind of... Is a more lifey way of pointing to the sublime or whatever. Which is something that isn't so present. None of that is present so much in... There's a bit of, like, portentous, like, chat, which kind of could point to that direction in Neuromancer, but I don't see it... I don't see the, like... One of the real strengths of the Blade Runner is that it alludes in a slightly more warm way.
The scene also contains one of these very explicit allusions to painting, where there's this moment, there's another sort of interview. Basically, the way that people work out if you're a replicant or not is by doing this sort of psychological test where they point a camera in your eye and ask you these kind of questions, like someone gives you a catskin wallet or something.
Oh no, it's always like you're doing something really horrible.
Yeah. You see a tortoise in the sand and you kick it over or whatever.
You look down and you see a tortoise, Leon. It's crawling towards
tortoise?
You.
Tortoise? What's that?
You know what a turtle is?
Of course.
Same thing.
Never seen a turtle. But I understand what you mean.
You reach down, you flip the tortoise over on its back, Leon.
Do you make up these questions, Mr. Holden? Or do they write them down for you?
The tortoise lays on its back, its belly baking in the hot sun, beating its legs, trying to turn itself over, but it can't. Not without your help. But you're not helping.
What do you mean I'm not helping?
I mean you're not helping. Why is that, Leon?
And there's this moment where it's the light is shot in a way which I think is like a very, very deliberate reference to a famous painting by Caravaggio with the calling of St. Matthew, which is in the chapel of San Luigi dei Francesi in Rome.
Is this your favourite painting, do you think?
Ooh, no, I don't think it is, but it's certainly up there. It's a wonderful, wonderful painting.
Is it in the top 10 best works in the world?
Yeah, definitely. And it has this very, very literal... It's something which is so on the nose that you can't believe that it works so well. This idea, like, light realisation is about to dawn. St. Matthew is about to raise his head and kind of see the light which is pouring in through the window.
Because all the incidental characters are so good as well.
Yeah, everything about it is wonderful. But it's, you know, it's one of the...
Is that reference, like, acknowledged in the film? Like, did people talk about that, or is that...
I believe so, yeah. I've no idea, actually. I know that the Van Eyck one later is.
Yeah, the Van Eyck one's pretty kind of, like, heavy-handed. But, which you kind of have to, like, be at all legible.
I don't know. I never really know. I sort of think these things are really obvious. You do occasionally encounter these things which are, like, super obvious, but which people actually haven't figured out.
Yeah, but the trope of, like, a ray of light casting, you know, over people's heads is a pretty broad trope. It wasn't invented by Caravaggio, and it's certainly been...
The table.
The crepuscular ray, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's very clear. And also, I think it's, like, it's just a thing about Ridley Scott, is that he comes out of art school and this very kind of conscious... quotation of paintings. For the purposes of the plot, it matters that the girl is actually a replicant and doesn't know it. The remainder of the film kind of goes between the replicants who are on Earth trying to figure out the secret to extend their lives and Deckard hunting them down. There's a fun scene around this time which takes place in the sort of the laboratory, which is an enormous fridge where the man makes the guy who makes cyborg eyes. I think it's quite an amazing space. Everything sort of furred with this layer of
yeah, and everything's frost. In sort of jelly tanks.
Yeah,
and it's another one of these environments of stitched, stuck, cobbled together things.
Also, this that sort of there's the fusion of the old Japanese guy who is doing the work is sustained by all of these pipes which come from the walls and plug into his. Body. So this sort of unsettling fusion of the technology and the body and the space all at the same time is going on.
Which I think is again that story of the environment, the collapse of like the world's ecosystem, yeah. And you're being now supported by machines instead of the natural support of, you know, light and air. Which, when I think about it, is one of the big shifts. Dystopian sci-fi before, you know, if you think of like A Clockwork Orange. It has a lot of the things. Yeah. It's got the sort of modernist set. It's set in a quite real world, a quite familiar world. It has like a lot of the sort of social problems. Yeah. And it's very concerned with... But it doesn't have this notion... But in a way, the world it's set in is much more real. It's not set in a world where the environment has changed and man is supported by robot, by like being plugged in... Like almost venously to machines.
Yeah, that's the thing, the kind of this destabilizing of the integrity of the body, I think. And, I mean, I don't know, because you do have dystopias of kind of environmental collapse going way back where...
Well, like like After London is almost in that direction, isn't it? Which is like, right.
Or even like The Time Machine, I guess, the underground.
The idea of a place not being suitable for people to live in, I think, has been around before. But that particular industrial nature of it, and the nature of like being plugged into machines.
Yeah, that little sort of fridge room, I guess, is a microcosm actually of the world.
That's what I mean. Like, there's a meta. It's like another sort of incidence of this thing of like being needing to be supported, and the things that are supporting you can be sleek and producty, or they can be cobbled together. But they're always necessary.
And there's this sort of important that all of his tubes aren't really long enough and they're all kind of tangled up in everything. Yeah.
It's very much like sort of bellows and vacuum cleaner. And
yeah.
It's got that technological ambiguity.
I just do eyes. Just eyes. Genetic design. Just eyes. You and Nexus, huh? I design your eyes.
If only you have seen... What I've seen with your eyes, or what's that effect?
I only make eyes!
Yeah. Deckard's flat is kind of a pair to the pyramid, which scene that we were in. I think actually it may be filmed in the same building, which is Frank Lloyd Wright's... I should know the name of it, to be honest. Or we should pretend that we know it. It's Frank Lloyd Wright's Ennis Brown House, which is it's the sort of Aztec-styled, it's this weird Aztec-styled one with these kind of cast concrete blocks.
Yeah, and they're like cast in a really like rustic way. They're highly rusticated. But his has, again, the feeling that we had in both of these, that like rich people get everything seamless, and otherwise you kind of live in reoccupied. This feels like that, you know, I think they've put some extra partition walls and blocked things off, so it feels rather like he's got a building built into a structure which has been a bit sort of retrofitted and things don't fit properly.
I mean, for me, it seems very like bunker-like. Although it's on like the 200th story or whatever, it's the ceiling is quite low. It's dark outside, and because of this use of these,
there aren't any windows, are there?
Are there windows? I think that it are. I think there are. Yeah, but not very many. But also the interior material treatment and things. Everything feels very sort of bunkerish. It's, you know, you need an awful lot of protection to kind of go on dwelling in the earth.
Yeah.
Although he does just walk out onto the balcony at some point, and it's all fine. It's one of the moments where you see one of the more spectacular of these enormous painted backdrops with the whole cityscape spread out behind him.
Oh, and there's the street.
Yeah.
Yeah, gotcha.
I'm not sure how conscious it is, but one of the things you were talking about is like these painted backdrops are extremely unreal in a way that, I mean, one of the things which it does is that it seems to allude to an earlier era of cinema. Like it seems to allude to kind of like expressionist film or something like that.
I thought for a little bit it was to do with a kind of like fourth wall, like is this a, you know, what is the relationship between the viewer and the story. I don't think any of that is really conscious, except that it is part of the creating of a setting which is slightly more delirious. You know, time can like speeds up and slows down, and people sort of change places a bit like they would in, you know, if you're not quite tracking what's going, you know, it's all this sort of switching, which leads to lots of rather fretful sort of analysis, but really it's just about consciousness of the film not being like totally awake and like naturalistic and in the world.
When I was talking about it with Anna, and one of the things she said, if you saw that view of the city in like bright sunlight, actually it would just look like the Fifth Element.
Even not quite that exotic. Like, toned down a lot more towards just being a slightly more turned-up version. Like, the whole purpose, the biggest effect of the city is that the atmosphere has become this incredibly solid thing, which is something that happens. It's a trick in science fiction. I mean, we had it right back in We, where the atmosphere becomes the most solid thing in a city of glass. Here, the atmosphere is... there will never be a blue sky. The world has turned against us. There will never be... We will always live indoors because outdoors is indoors now because it's never bright.
Yeah.
It's never breezy.
Yeah.
There's no picnics in the park anymore. Oh, the other thing I'd say about the flat is it's a bit like my old landlord's flat where he'd like transposed his like suburban Richmond setting into the Brutalist.
Yeah, it's very full of furniture, isn't it?
In that it's got like old pianos and sort of Victorian photos and lots of this stuff which feels transposed straight out of noir, or Victoriana or whatever, or, you know, like not Victoriana, 20th century.
It's curious, isn't it? It's one of the things Deckard presents as this disaffected, cynical character. So when did he go furniture shopping for all this stuff?
He sort of has this hyper-empty life, in the sense of family, which is, like, foregrounded by all the photographs of his family members, presumably all lovers, or, you know, these wistful black-and-white photographs of women, of the kind of constituency of a past which is highly suppressed.
It's one of the things which is peculiar about the film, and which I think is unintended, is that so he goes to the flat. He has with him this sort of clue, which is that all of the android replicants who only live for 4 years, they're given a sort of a fake past, which is implanted in their memory, and they're also given these little artifacts which tap into it to reinforce it in the form of lots and lots of photos and postcards and things like this. And he has with him this pile of evidence, which are all of the photos from left behind by the escaped replicants, But then strangely surrounding that is all of his own stuff, which just looks like the same kind of thing. And one of the readings of the film, which has got this sort of like cult attachment to it, is like, is Deckard meant to be a replicant? I think in the sequel, which is currently, which is like shortly to be released, it's very apparent that he's not. But the film actually, I think, is much more interesting if that ambiguity is there.
I think I read that, just looking at the film, I think I read the ambiguity slightly like lower down the like complexity scale, which is just that there is an ambiguity about what is about the difference between the robots and the humans and the animals and the thing. It's just that, is everybody, I would say it's more like, is everybody a replicant? What's the difference? It doesn't say there is no difference. It just is like, as with so much of it, the ambiguity is the point.
Yeah.
Which is quite a common, quite often you get these like deliberately ambiguous works. I mean, a really famous example is like The Wasteland is very ambiguous and people got a bit grumpy with its ambiguity. And so T.S. Eliot writes the like all the Niner Notes, which are just trolling. They're all just like making like these ridiculous made up references, or you know, like C. Parsifal.
Yeah, that's the
225.
That's like, the best thing. Yeah, no, like the kind of references which you were.
Which just points to the fact that actually there's nothing behind it. It's just about creating a sense of something, like in a person at a moment. And even if there was something behind it, it wouldn't be any. It wouldn't mean anything. You can't have any more meaning than a feeling.
Enhanced 224 to 176. Enhance. Stop. Move in. Stop. Pull out track right. Stop. Center and pull back. Stop. Track 45 right. Stop. Center and stop. Enhance 34 to 36.
There are these two other like scenes which occur in the flat, which I think are really some of the most interesting. One's the one you alluded to already, this weird, unexplained dream he has about a unicorn running between trees. It's sort of like tossing its head wildly, I think, in order to try and shake the thing that's stuck to its forehead off. You can see it's really, really pissed off. The other is this strange computerized analysis of a photo, which I think is one of the most iconic. Yeah.
It's another pre-user illusion computer experience, which is always charming.
So he puts the photo into this, it's kind of like a floppy disk drive, which takes the photo in and loads it up.
It has a strong like microfiche thing as well, I think. Microfiche, for our younger listeners,
yeah,
is how we used to get like newspapers in the library, which is that they put them on little tiny photographic plates and you look at them through a sort of big like microscope.
So let's talk about this scene a little bit. The photo presents an interior. There's a guy sitting on an armchair on the left-hand side. There's a doorway leading through. And then through the doorway, we can see that there's another room in which there's some sort of dresser and above it a circular mirror. The lighting of the scene presents us another sort of quite conscious allusion to painting, I think.
Yeah, there's at least three sets of painting references in it, which is that the original setup is a Dutch or, you know, that sort of European softly lit Vermeer-y or Hammershoy-y interior.
Yeah.
With the sort of, you know, white painted door, the ambiguous figure, the soft light. Then it like we pan into a really classic still life.
Yeah.
Of several objects, which there's almost a moment when it just becomes, the film just becomes looking at a still life as a sort of gesture towards peace and emptiness. So still knives are very, very empty, because they're always about, like, the feast without the feast. And then there's the really obvious one, which is this convex mirror, which is a sort of lift out of the Arlfini wedding.
Yeah, by Jan van Eyck.
Jan van Eyck, which is in the National Portrait. And like, seeing the, you know, in the Arlfini, there is like a figure who is sort of the observer, a third person in the scene. I think it's more a third person in the scene than the artist. It's an officiator, or you. I think it's more like, oh, what's that painting of the barmaid? Impressionist. It's more like you in that, you know, this like blurred out top hat figure.
I know the one you mean. As you pan into the picture, somewhere in the depths of the mirror, it locates the front of a sort of full-height wardrobe with mirrored doors, which it then sort of zooms further into. And then in this curious moment, I've watched it a few times, I used to think it was different from what it actually is. In fact, at this moment, the technology becomes magical, and the camera is able to move in parallax in space, and to change its orientation with regard to the mirrored front of this wardrobe, so as to catch a reflection of a sleeping woman who is Zora, one of the replicants.
Although only like the third figure in the wedding portrait, very blurrily.
Yeah, and in fact, this is what one of the like weirdnesses in the film, not the actress who played her, but rather another one who looks vaguely, but actually not very much like her.
Which I think is the correct decision.
It's really weird.
It's ambiguous.
Yeah. So I came across this nice essay, which I'll link to in the show notes. It poses the question, is the camera's eye a lens or a mirror? Does the film open a portal onto reality, giving us access to the look and texture of another time and place? Or does film reflect back to the apparatus of its own production, offering us the image of an artificial constructed world? So it's kind of framing this whole scene as this sort of self-conscious investigation or acknowledgement of the dual nature of film there. I think that in a way the most interesting part of the film is that period of looking at the still life was almost the weirdest bit, where you're just looking at this.
Yeah, there's a moment when you're looking at a photograph, which is just a photograph of a still life.
Yeah.
Because obviously this isn't done by just cropping a photograph. It's done with several images, some of which are then cropped. And one of them is just a photograph of a still life.
The kind of camera eye is a motif that appears lots of times in the films. There's the Voigtkamp interview technique relies on shining a camera in right into someone's eye, and that you have a lot of these images just of the iris and pupil.
And actually, here's a big thing. There's loads of red eye in the film, like very intentionally produced. Mm. Loads of like you see the people's retinas.
Yeah,
they shine lights behind the actors, particularly the replicants. I don't know if it's entirely the replicants, but they've got this thing that like you can see their retinas.
Yeah,
the whole scene is kind of reveling in the artificiality of the process of making film, so that film can present as kind of verisimilitude. It can present as like this view which is like real life. It's all, you know, it's like it's your own eyes. It's a thing which I remember,
but which the whole film is actually distancing itself from.
Yeah, no, that's what it does. Well, it's sort of to do that in a very, very,
oh, we see but through a glass darkly, eh?
Yeah, well,
it's the thing, mirror, the mirror is not the thing.
It's a thing that I remembered that Michel Haneke's Hidden does, Caché, does really. There's this scene which happens a few times where there's like...
Another jolly film from Haneke.
Yeah. I remember there's this lovely bit, which I think has actually happened several times, where you have this view, it feels like you're sitting in the back of a car, you're looking out the front window of the car as it drives around. And it's sort of, the movement of the car, it makes it immersive, even though nothing is really happening. And then you realise, actually, we're all watching a video of this thing on the television. This sort of weird, jarring moment, which it does multiple times to sort of suck you in and then distance you again. And this is really doing a similar sort of thing. It's because of the way in which it's paced and the way in which it kind of forces you to peer right into all of these details, and the way in which everything is sort of very exquisitely rendered in this sort of painting-like way, you get very kind of drawn into this thing, but which is also revealing, kind of tipping its hand, kind of revealing its own artificiality and its own kind of reflection.
Something we haven't said is that this is a big budget sci-fi film. Budget's bigger than the first Star Wars film or Tron or, you know, like it's about the same as Empire Strikes Back. And he's messing around with like Dutch still life paintings and like and the nature of the observer and like and you know it's got a bit of like Plato, you know, images on the cave wall or whatever hackneyed metaphor for that sort of thing you want to dredge up.
The other thing which has been brought up in connection with it is this idea of the male gaze with it as this recurring trope within cinema, that sort of things happen in films through male activity and female passivity, that men sort of are. What's kind of interesting is that the male gaze in this case is this kind of hyper-technologic, kind of technologized prosthesis.
The visual trope.
Yeah.
It's good. Like a lot of things, it's at a tangent slightly to, you know, the Force. The film has got some... I got told off for saying something was centrifugal. Oh, we can cut that out. I remember what that was. That was me going like, why have you put all the pictures of your thing at opposite ends of the wall in the crypt?
I think it's one of the reasons why you can't, why Scott doesn't really hold it together at any films after this, that, you know, stuff like this, stuff like the Unicorn Dream, stuff like the big fossilized space jockey in the Alien film, they're things that are just, he has these images and he just pursues them relentlessly, but you're not going to keep getting it right forever.
Yeah, but also it's about the feeling, there's nothing behind it.
Yeah. Do we want to say anything else? So the things which are left to talk about in the film are like the various killings, the flat of the...
J.F. Sebastian.
This kind of finale, which I think we should talk a tiny bit about.
This is my saviour, J.F. Sebastian.
It's another repurposing of a sort of Gilded Age.
Yeah, so this is the Bradbury building, which is a downtown apartment building in L.A.
Yeah.
But very well dressed, full of kind of puddles of water and looking very ruinous.
Steam.
Yeah.
And it is empty and abandoned. Everyone has left.
Yeah. And it's this, he comes into the story as the route for the replicants to get inside the big pyramid and go and meet their maker. So the whole flat is full of all of these sort of grotesque, animatronic, sort of semi-cyborgs.
It's got that, it's like a very successful sort of, like, theatrical background, student mannequin collection. Again, like a repurposed cliche, which has got an obvious, like, ponderous reference of, you know, these are more machine-y, but they're like puppets, they're like the robots, are they people? Which I'm not sure is really our concern here.
No, there's a good spooky moment where one of the replicants like disguises herself in among all of this whole... Yeah, all of these dwarfs just sits very, very still. It's extremely spooky. But yeah, no, there's not that much to say about the setting. I mean, apart from that it becomes the setting for the kind of finale of the film, where there's this lot of sort of smashing through walls and things.
Again, the, like, application... It is an archetypical mythic world, and so you can have the rain and doves and this stuff that would feel like almost like sort of occult ham, where it handled a little less aptly. But I think that probably... I think that's stuff which isn't really stuff you can do in a building. Making it rain and imbuing it with mythic animals.
Yeah, there's a lot of... I'm not sure what's meant to have happened in terms of the staging. I guess that they're meant to have gone up more floors.
They go up, and the top of the building is ruined because it's been abandoned.
It's a kind of sponge.
And it's got lots of holes. I mean, you do have... Like, if you have... Do you have... have you... Like, I don't know how much time you spent, like, breaking into derelict buildings, but you do have that scene where, like, we normally compartmentalise rooms as spaces. But, like, if you're looking at it in a kind of Cartesian viewpoint, there's no reason that the space can't be in them, you know. There's no reason that, you know, one space can't bleed into another, although they're mentally very separate to each other. Once holes start appearing in the fabric, you can break through one thing into another. But this has again, is like a freighted with a sort of mythic significance because, you know, he's climbing through clocks or whatever.
There's a good, it's got, like, it gets to a good sort of pitch of hysterical intensity when the building is being smashed apart by Rutger Hauer's character.
Well, yeah, who becomes a divine force, doesn't he?
Yeah, he's smashing his head through walls and things.
Quite an experience to live in fear, isn't it? That's what it is to be a slave.
Yeah, he has some fun, I think. But it can't end with the sun coming up, which would be the classic one, because there is no sun.
Well, there is the suggestion that the sun is slightly coming up as Roy Batty, the last remaining android, kind of delivers him his sort of insane last words. There's a sort of change in
the light. More Christian. I hadn't really seen the sort of stigmata and stuff until but it's quite...
He layers it on thick. Actually, one of the miracles of the film is that it works as well as it does with so much cheesy stuff kind of
I know. Laid on. Like when you like list them, when you've got sort of shopping lists of cliches, it's quite damning, but it's not really like not that bad.
Yeah, he literally like
his hand is like pierced with a big nail.
Yeah, he sticks, I don't know what is it he's trying to sort of keep himself awake. He like
he's going to die. He's got his like programmed cell death. Which it has got a lot more there's been a lot of like father, son, creator, savior, sin, all that sort of stuff has been sloshing around. And he's got to put a big nail through his hand. Yeah.
It's another one of these very hyper-real painted backdrop scenes. The point where Deckard kind of hangs off the building, and there's this perspective which is really more of a like kind of false perspective that he's falling into
to suck you down.
Yeah.
And the rain.
Tears in rain.
Yeah. We're all like moments. All those moments, they're going to be lost like tears in rain.
Which is, I think you probably already know this, but this is all for fun. That's not in the script. Rather, the speech is in the script, but the speech in the script is much less fruity. And that the actual words as delivered just come out of the hysterical intensity of Rutger Hauer.
Great.
He said, I've written... Which is a thing which actors do quite a lot, and I think almost never has a good outcome. But he said, I've written something, and you have to film it. And that was the speech, he wrote it.
Like the other one, The Third Man.
Oh, right, is that...
As in Swiss. Democracy. State of Democracy.
Oh, we've been talking for ages.
We call it? Let's call it a day and see what we can salvage out of that. We'll cobble together something out of this Frankenstein monster. We'll be back to a mixture of the obscure and deliberate, and obviously architectural shortly.
Yeah.
You've all been wonderful.
I'm just going to drop in a good quote from the film here, and it's going to be lovely.
Time to die.
Yeah.
You've adopted my lovely, Luke.
Yeah. That's the end.
Well, hopefully you won't all vanish like so many tears in the rain.
Yeah.
And we'll see you next time.
Right.
Like us on all appropriate channels or whatever.
Yeah. AboutBuildingCities.org. AboutBuildingCities@gmail.com. Twitter, Facebook, and the like, all available on the homepage.
Bye.